Good afternoon. Don't mess with Texas. Well, they put a meeting.
Step away from the mic.
They put a meeting format in front of me because Rick knows me. It's a little bit scary here. It says, introduce yourself. How can I do that in an hour and a half? For those who don't know, I am standing up. To my Canadian friends. To my Texas friends. To my United States friends. And to the world. If you meant to go to the stooping, boring, glum meeting, you are in the wrong room. Please leave now. This is our celebrating sobriety meeting, and what a, gosh, I really sound like I'm yelling. Can you see me in the back? I asked for a large room. Okay, I'm an incredibly attractive alcoholic with a keen fashion sense. They call me Kathy. My home group is the Cerrito Canova Serenity Group. It meets in Cerrito, Almost Heaven, Wild and Wonderful, West, by God, Virginia. Yes, we are a state. My sobriety date's August 12, 1994. For those of y'all who are mathematically challenged, that's 75 years of continuous sobriety. This format's going to be a little bit different. I'm going to talk 45 minutes, and I'm going to let each of our speakers have five if we have time. A quick little story to loosen y'all up a little bit. My husband came down with me, but he's not here with me tonight. My husband is spending the weekend with an old friend, and they're going to reminisce, and they're going to drink beer. And for this weekend, he went out and bought 2 4-packs of beer. For a weekend. He bought them on Monday. What are you going to do? Well, I've now introduced myself. More will be revealed. I'm now to ask for a moment of silence. More importantly, those of y'all who have cell phones or iPhones or those kind of thingies, please take a minute and make sure they're on off, because in this particular meeting, the people sitting next to you have permission to grab it and stomp it. And I'm the vice president. Now to the meat and potatoes, or beans and burritos. Now the part that I know Mary's dreading, it's called the introduction of speakers. Well, Mary likes to go first. Well, her husband is on another panel, so she may scooty-poot out when it's over. And so she loves this more than anything. She lives to get behind the microphone. That's a lie. I've met Mary before. And without further ado, I give you Mary P. from Florida.
My name's Mary P., and I'm an alcoholic. Everybody, my sobriety date is November 27th, 1981. My home group is the College Park Triangle Group in Orlando, Florida. And I'm wearing this interesting headgear because I'm having a bad hair day, and it's meant to distract you. I've had a bad hair day since 1981. Before that, I'm not so sure I was drunk a lot. And I'm really delighted to be here. I'm very grateful for this opportunity. I was hoping there would be 15 of you, and there seemed to be a few more. So I'm grateful for the rest of you, I guess, but I'll calm down in a minute. I am a girl who came from a nice, normal family. That does happen. We become alcoholics, too. My parents were married 62 years when my dad died. No divorces, no beatings, no arrests, no nothing. Just a grandmother that was a member of the Women's Christian Temperance Union in West Virginia. And I'm named after her. It didn't go so well, but she died before she found that out. I grew up in Miami. It's a wonderful place to grow up back then. It was beautiful. I had a really nice childhood, except I had two brothers, which I had nothing to do with. That wasn't my fault. And I was a good student. I went to college, and I did not drink at all in high school. Actually, I thought cigarettes got you pregnant, so don't smoke around me, please. I did. I was one of those girls. You know, the guys rolled. Anyway, it's another story. Ask me about that later. I went to college on a scholarship at a fine Southern Baptist university. I did not drink there. My roommate did. I thought that was kind of cool, but I was too terrified to drink. And then I met a boy. You know, I found out one of the causes of alcoholism, one of the symptoms, is boys. I bet you didn't know that. In my case, that's absolutely true. And it can be girls, too, but in my case, it's boys. And so I met this boy, and he had a lot of money, and he liked me, and I thought that was fine. And he drank, I didn't, but he didn't drink at school. And then his parents invited me to go to the Bahamas on their yacht. We didn't do yachts in Bahamas in my family, but my parents let me go. And in Nassau, when I was 19 years old on Bay Street, I had my first drink. I went to a little bar called Dirty Dick's. I am not making that up. And my mother-in-law-to-be suggested that I try a Tom Collins, which I did 6 times in about a half an hour. And I enjoyed it so much. You know, many people get taller and prettier and all that when they drink. Not this girl. I get louder. I get more empowered. I had feminism going on before I knew the word. I had things to say, and I had never said them. When I'm sober, I'm scared. When I'm drunk, I'm a dynamo. And so I thought it was time to tell this boy what was wrong with him in 4-letter words that I had read in all those good books I was reading. And so I cussed him out in front of his parents, and I threw up, and I passed out, and they carried me back to the yacht in the Bahamas. And that was not a good beginning. So, of course, he married me. What else do you do with a girl like me? And I was really, really confused. I didn't know what it was to be married. I do now. I did that about every 3 years for the next 10 years. I try not to overdo. You know, if you get married too long, they start expecting you to stay, and that's not a good thing. And I used to drink water glasses of scotch in the kitchen before I went out to give me the confidence I needed to drink. You have to drink before you drink, and if you don't understand that, you're not my kind of alcoholic. But he got tired of me, and I got bored with him. All those trips to Paris, you know, God knows. And so I dumped him for a really good-looking artist and got him to travel around the world, and we did that. And I was just a crazy girl. I was very well-educated and dangerous, you know, and my outside life looked better than my inside life. And so the artist and I hit Europe for a while, and I had a baby that I wasn't expecting. It wasn't cigarettes, by the way. Talk to me about that later, too. So I had this wonderful baby girl and got home, and we moved to Florida, and I love Florida, and then I got bored again, and he got boring, and he had to go. You know how it is. I think that was 4 years. He'd made it a little longer because of that pregnancy. And then drinking, all the time drinking, and thinking that I wouldn't have to drink if I met the right guy. Is that sad or what? You know, but my parents had this wonderful marriage, and so I figured it worked for them, right? So I just had to keep trying until I found that relationship, and so then it was the bicentennial year, and I married Uncle Sam. That seemed like a good plan. It was the actor who played Uncle Sam in this play. And so we traveled around the country. I was a carny for a while, dragging my 2-year-old daughter with me and using that fine economics degree from this fine university by counting the change, you know, that I picked up along the way. And I lived one day at a time, and I got drunk every day and lived in a truck house. And It's just a sordid little story, you know, and that's what it was like. And all the time I kept thinking, it's going to get better. It's going to get, something will get better. And I'd always come to the end of the road. Now, I married Uncle Sam on February 29th, which is leap day. I thought that might help, but it didn't. It didn't. We only made it through one anniversary, and then he had to go too. But I found the answer. You know, if you really want to ratchet up your drinking, find somebody that drinks just like you do. Oh, I found him. Yes, I did. He was in my Uncle Sam guy decided to go back to school, get educated, and get a real job, which right there kind of put me off. And at that time, I was the director of a parent education program at a college. You know, their background checks aren't what they are today, let me tell you. And so I meet this guy, and he takes me down to his car, and he pops the trunk, and there's a whole trunk full of call brands and ice right there in his trunk. And I'm like, I'm in love. So he became my next future husband, and he was married, but that never bothered me before. I had a divorce dress and a lawyer on speed dial. It wasn't a problem. So I explained to Uncle Sam that I couldn't live with him anymore. And during that time, my alcoholism had progressed to the point where one night I went out for a business meeting. I was selling pharmaceuticals, like for real, like legally, not the other kind. And I went out for a business meeting at the Saints and Sinners Lounge in Altamont Springs, Florida. I had business meetings in places like that because you could like have the meeting and then get drunk all at the same time. It was great. And this guy said something I didn't like, and I threw a drink, and he threw a drink, and they threw us out, and I got lost up there, and I had left my daughter with a babysitter in daycare, and I forgot to pick her up, you know? I just forgot completely to pick her up, and that's what alcohol did for me. And the truth is, I didn't forget to pick her up. I forgot I had her. When I drink, there's no daughter. There's nothing. There's just the alcohol and me. And the next thing I want to do, the self-centeredness was incredible. And I love my child. I loved her then, and I love her now. But alcohol stole that from me. And I got home, and I made this little list about, I want to be a good wife. I don't know how. I keep trying. God knows. I want to be a good mother, and I want to quit drinking for 30 days, and I just couldn't do it. So I didn't quite marry him. This guy just couldn't get divorced. He was married to this Al-Anon. Forgive me, all the Al-Anons out there. I'm sorry I didn't get it. And she kept saying, let go and let God, stuff like that. And I'm like, come on, you know, I don't hang around unmarried for more than, say, 2-3 months. I mean, that's just too nerve-wracking for me. So on one fateful night, we go to Jacksonville, and we're going to celebrate my brother's birthday. And we go to a bar. Where else do we go? And he gets in a fight with me and walks out. Well, nobody walks out unmarried. No, no, no. So he walks out, and I follow eventually to explain that nobody walks out. And he's like this, and they're hitting his head on the Crown Victoria, and I'm like, oh, this is not good. So I try to explain to the nice man why he shouldn't be doing this. He said, listen, little lady, I'm going to put you in the car if you're not careful. So I'm like, this is not good. This is not good. We don't need to be arrested. So I go to the Duval County Jail, which has a smell in the restroom that's so incredibly special if you've never been in a restroom of a jail. And I'm looking at myself in the mirror, and I'm thinking, what's a nice girl like you doing in a place like this? And the mirror talked back and said, you're not such a nice girl anymore, Mary, and you're going to die. So I finally get the genius out of the Duval County Jail after he finally comes to and will give them his real name. And we're driving back to Orlando, and he said, we need to do something. I'm like, oh, yeah, we need to do something. I said, I think we should go to therapy. I personally love therapy. You pay people and you can whine. It's great. Just great. You know, I thought that was just so great. And I knew all kinds of people in mental health. God, what a surprise. And he didn't like that idea. So we get home and he has a new plan, not my plan. And his plan is he's going to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, have you lost your mind? I don't have a drinking problem. It's just, I have issues. I do. I have issues. But he was determined to go. And I realized if I let him go alone, that he would go to an AA meeting and he would meet alcoholic sluts like myself. And somebody would grab up my next future husband, and I could not have that. So I went in disguise, dressed myself in men's clothes, had a big hat on, big glasses. And I thought I was rather overdressed for how I perceived AA to be. And I walked in, and they made me right away, "Are you new?" I'm like, "Hmm." And this girl gave me a big book, and her name was Diane. She's just precious. She's still sober today and a real light in Alcoholics Anonymous. She comes coming up, and what I noticed is she had a white linen suit that was quite expensive, and I thought, maybe I could stay for a while. And I did stay for a while, for a long time. And that group was wonderful to me, and I was taken through the steps. I used to take people to detox, and I was afraid they were going to keep me because I looked worse than the people I was taking. And I had a wonderful first year of sobriety, and had a little, except my sponsor told me, don't get married. Do not get married. But God had spoken to me directly and said, get married. And I said, okay, God. I was like that. And so I had a little AA wedding with little AA bridesmaids and little AA punch and little AA cake, and I lived happily ever after. Not. And the husband decided that AA wasn't working so well for him, and he went to work in a treatment center and learned too much and decided to quit going to meetings, and he'd go once a year and pick up a medallion. And for the next 10 years, my life went way, way, way downhill. I have never been without, I've never spent a week of my sobriety without being in an AA meeting, never. But I have spent many years lying in meetings, and I don't recommend it. I've never been without a sponsor, but I have been with sponsors that had no idea what was going on in my life, and I don't recommend it. So I got to 10 years sober, and I thought death looked like a good idea. And finally, I got this sponsor who I call the industrial strength. Her name's Terry L. in Orlando, fabulous woman from New York, who said something to the effect of, get the heck out of there, for God's sake. And I thought there was a rule against how many times you could be married. And I was already up to four, and I was 34 years old, and so I was really worried that five was like over the limit and they kicked you out. So I got out, and that marriage ended. My daughter by this time is in college away from home, and she's okay, and I'm really happy about that. And I lost my house, went bankrupt, lost my job. I did the things newcomers do, like, what's up with that? You know, I've been sober way too long for this, but I wasn't. I was just stubborn as heck. Oh, and I did one more thing. I met a boy, but this one I met years before, and he was a friend of mine. I'd never married a friend. I found that like a weird idea. That was a new idea. So after the divorce, well, I had to get divorced first, which is pretty easy because I have a brown divorce dress that just looks like hell, you know, and that's what you wear when you get divorced all the time. And this guy was perfect for me because he was a divorce lawyer. I mean, how great is that, you know? And so his friend walked the divorce through, and we get done. And I've been divorced, 17, 18 minutes max. And he says, you know what? I don't have another client till 11, 11:30. I'm a lawyer. I can get the final papers. Why would you get married now? And the answer to that question in my life is always yes. So I married him. And I have to tell you, on Thursday when we got here to the hotel, I was sitting there going, oh, my God. Today is the anniversary of my very first marriage, 43 years ago. I've been married my whole life, except for a few little breaks in there. And I never saw it as a symptom of my alcoholism. But I was chasing marriage as the answer to my problem. And it never occurred to me that alcoholism was the problem. So I married this guy. And we've been married 18 consecutive years with no breaks. I think that's kind of, for me, yeah, that's pretty darn good. Woo! He's very cool. He's sitting on the front row going, oh, my God. But we started tripping through happy destiny, and I knew I had to do something with my life. The pharmaceutical thing wasn't working, so I went to graduate school. And instead of becoming spiritual, which was what I had planned until my sponsor laughed, I became a marriage counselor. I'm really good. And I'll tell you why I'm so good, because there is nothing anybody has ever done stupid that I haven't done. So I can pick up their tricks like they walk in the office and I got them. I love my job, I love my work, and I sit in there and I think, you know, it's just kind of amazing that I'm in this place in my life, that it's possible for me to have a real career and a real marriage. My daughter, God bless her, she was 8 when I came in, she's 37 now, she turned out beautifully, and she loves me, and she trusts me, and she cares for me. And I took my granddaughter, I have an 11-year-old granddaughter, and she's so much... Get this, she wanted to go see the Backstreet Boys. Like, whatever. You know, I'm the Gracie Slick, you know, girl, Bob Dylan. She wants to see the Backstreet Boys. So, okay, grandma's going to be cool and take her. So I take her to this concert, and we get in there, and you know how it is. Crowds, 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 and then you sit down, and you wait and wait, and then opening act, and the lights go up, and there are the Backstreet Boys. And my little, sweet, demure 11-year-old granddaughter is transformed from this little, sweet girl. And she stands up, starts crying and screaming, AJ, I love you, AJ, AJ. And I'm thinking, aw, isn't that sweet? Remember the old days? So this morning I come in here, crowds. And listen to some speakers. Then Clancy comes on. And I stand up, and I start screaming, Clancy, I love you! I start crying. Some things never change, girls. Some things never change. I have been so blessed, and I have a fabulous home group. They meet on Thursday nights, and every Thursday I go to my home group, and I'm surrounded by love and recovery and service and the kind of people I want to be with. And after that meeting is over and the lights are closed down, I go to my daughter's house because she has a new baby, 2 months old, and I spend every Thursday night overnight with the baby. Women who drive drunk with their daughters in the car, women who forget their children, women who get married way too many times like me, don't get to be responsible for their grandchildren. But I do. I do because of you. And it reminds me of something we read at the end of our meeting every week, the last line of the 12th tradition long form. May our great blessings never spoil us. May we forever live in thankful contemplation of him who presides over us all. Thank you for my sobriety. Thank you for my life. I bless you.
I'll try not. Can you hear me?
Jump.
Okay, before I introduce our gentleman, I'm going to share a little more with you. You know, sometimes mostly we hear men up here and they talk about, like, physically how bad a shape they are when they got here. And they'll say, when I got here, I weighed X amount. Well, some of us women don't really find that interesting, because when I first got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I weighed 128 pounds. I hope I get back there someday. And now the one guy in this sea of femininity, I don't know Ken, he got up here, he said he was really nervous, so I sent him on an errand. So he bought water for all of us. But anyway, I'm sure it's going to be good, and if it's not, I didn't ask him to be on the panel. So here's Ken.
Hi, my name's Ken. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is August 2nd, 1999. My home group is the Pepperell Spiritual Awakening Meeting. We meet on Monday nights. You're all welcome. Not all at once, though. Gosh, there's a lot of you. Could you indulge me while I say a quick little prayer? God, get me out of this so I'll never drink again. I made the mistake of walking through this room on the way to registration on Thursday, and it just kept going and going and going and going, and a friend of mine calls this the aircraft hangar. Anyway, the only way I know to tell my story is from the beginning and then work my way up. I didn't do a lot of drinking as a teenager. I mostly did other substances. But I was alone. I had friends, but I always felt like I didn't belong. I always felt like no matter where I was, I didn't fit in. No matter who I was with, they were better than me. I just didn't fit in. And growing up, I just had that feeling that, that aliens were going to come down and explain to me that I was put on the wrong planet or something like that, and then it would all get better. And it didn't. And it just kept, I just was empty. And I was trying to fill my life with other things. And then I was in college, and I was introduced to my first love, alcohol. And I was on a date with this girl, and she started drinking off of a bottle of Tango. And I just couldn't stand the smell of alcohol. The taste of it just made me nauseous. And she said, no, you take a couple of quick slugs, you get you right past that. And she was right. And I fell deeply, madly in love that night. I cannot tell you how much I love that alcohol. I couldn't remember her name for several years until I got sober. But I remember everything I drank that night. And that once that alcohol grabbed me, there wasn't anything else that would do. I needed that alcohol. I needed that. It was the only thing that was taking the edge off my life. And my life wasn't bad. I just felt it was bad. I just didn't fit in. I was scared and, I just didn't like people. And alcohol changed all that. As soon as I had that first drink, I loved everybody. Everybody. I loved you deeper than anything else in the world. I loved you as long as you're buying. And I surrounded myself with people that drank, and I just sort of gave up on everything else in life. I just floated around, did other things that were expected of me, but I didn't participate in life except for the drinking part. I met my wife at that college. She wasn't my wife at the time, obviously. And our first date was several years after college. I'm going to tell you about this. This will explain my marriage. I'm still married today to the same wonderful woman, but this is how our marriage started off. Our first date, she was living in Connecticut. I'm in Massachusetts. And I drove down to visit her. And when I showed up, it was her nephew's third birthday party. It was a keg party. And she explained that she had a blind date that she had to go on. Did I mind staying there with her brothers? And her brothers are very nice men, construction workers and Marines. And the smallest one of her brother's friends came over to me and shook my hand. He said, you hurt her, we break your legs. And she left me there. She left. And I'm there with these, I was 145 pounds in college. I've changed a little bit since then. And she left me with her brothers, and I was alone. And then I saw the keg, and I was home. And I fit in. I was talking to the construction workers about laying cement. I was talking to the Marines about going on missions. And I was whatever you wanted to be at that time. And I was just fitting right in. And then most of it I don't remember. But I've been told that when she came back from her blind date, her sister-in-law pulled her aside and said, Ken's nothing but a no-good alcoholic. Drop him immediately. He's going to bring you nothing but pain. And I'm going to say this right now. Vanessa, you are a very wise woman. I brought a lot of pain to our marriage. We ended up getting married. Just happened. We kind of eloped. Actually, we eloped because one of my sister-in-law doesn't get sarcasm. But that's a long story, and I don't have a couple hours. But and I just sort of started, I went to a job because that was expected of me. I didn't actively participate in my life. I just sort of bounced and just drank and just sort of was there in physicality only. I was, you needed me to be somewhere and you drove me, I'd be there. If I didn't have to go, I wouldn't. I'd stay alone. I hated people. Hated you. Unless you're buying. At a certain point in this time, early in my marriage, I started realizing alcohol was taking over my life. And I started fighting it. I started trying to control it because I had seen what alcohol and drugs can do to people. I have several relatives that this disease has taken hold of, and one of them is no longer with us. And I've seen what it does to people, and I didn't want that happening to me. So I fought, and I started doing things because, you know, alcoholics, I drank only in bars because alcoholics drink at home, you know. Never occurred to me alcoholics drink in bars, too. I would go to a bar and I'd surround myself with people by buying them all drinks because alcoholics drank alone. I didn't want to be an alcoholic. So I started, you know, I didn't stop drinking. That'd be nuts. But I started doing the things that I thought alcoholics didn't do. And it just started taking me and taking me and taking me. And it got to the point where I was no longer controlling when and where I drank or how much. I was fighting it tooth and nail because I saw what was happening and I knew in my head that this was going to kill me, but I didn't have the power to fight it. About 4 years before I ended up getting sober, I was in the hospital. I had blood into my stomach for a week and passed out on one morning getting ready for work. And the emergency guys came up and they put me on the gurney and they said, "Well, how much do you drink, sir?" And I said, "Well, I have a couple now and then." And they brought me to the hospital and the emergency doctor said, "Well, sir, how much do you have to drink?" And I said, "Well, I have a couple now and then." And finally the surgeon comes in, the one that's going to go in and fix me up, and she's talking to me. She says, "So how much do you drink?" And I was tired of this question. And I was trying to think in my head a number that would be like high enough that there'd be damage, but not high enough that they'd think, like, lock me up or something. So I'm trying to think, you know, and honestly, at that point, I couldn't tell you how much I drank at any one point because I just blacked out all the time. I would just drink until I blacked out and then keep drinking. And, you know, I didn't know how much I drank, 20, 30, who knows? You know, I don't know. So I was thinking, well, 8? And her eyes just got big. And she said, "If you drink again, you're going to die." So I'm in the hospital bed. I'm looking like death. My wife brings in my two boys. We had two boys at the time. And I thought I was going to die. And I swore I would never drink again. Every ounce of my body just said, "I will never drink again." And I meant it from the bottom of my heart. And 5 weeks later, I was drunk. I was in a bar, and me and the bartender were having a conversation. I was talking about having to have my stomach fixed up, and we decided between us that white Russians have milk in them. Milk's good for your stomach. There you go. I can drink white Russians. I think the punchline to that is I'm lactose intolerant. So I just kept drinking for 4 years, and things started happening. My life, you know, my internal life started going down. The external life, from the outside, it looked like I had it all. I had a good job, I had family, lovely wife, wonderful kids. I was just empty. I was a shell. I didn't know why. And I knew alcohol was killing me. And right after I started drinking, after that hospital trip, I've heard say that, like, a drowning person eventually just gives up and lets the water take them. I did that with alcohol. I stopped fighting. I just let it just consume me. I knew it was hopeless. I was going to die from alcoholism. I'd seen it done. I was just going to die. Through a long series of events, I found myself being sentenced to AA. And I thought that was the end of it, you know. At that time, I had in my head two visions of AA that were completely different. One of them was old-time Baptist revival meeting. There'd be lots of singing and dancing. There'd be a big tank of water up here, and somebody'd be dunking somebody in the water, and everybody'd be saved. The other was one of those circle groups. Everybody sits around and whines for a couple hours about their problems. Somehow I had both those pictures in my head, so when they told me I had to go to AA 3 times a week for 4 months, I mean, I'm thinking, 3 times? How can I get to 3 meetings a week? I'm like, that's impossible. And I did it, but I still remember my first meeting. And the first meeting I went to, I need to share this because I think this is kind of where my life started. I I got sentenced to AA, and it was about a month before I went to my first meeting because I was terrified of what you all were. I thought you were all religious freaks or something. And my wife was going on vacation, said, if you don't get that court slip signed when I get back, you're gone. I'm taking the house, the kids, everything, you're out. And that was the first time in a long time that she had actually said something to me that was off our little script. At that point in our marriage, we had our lines. I had said my line, she said her line. We didn't vary from it. It'd be like I'd call her up from work. Honey, I have to work late. Okay, but don't stay out too late. I won't. Well, don't drink too much. I'll try not to. You know, back and forth. And that was the first time she went off script. So I got all the courage I could to get to that meeting. And I was outside that meeting, and I saw a bunch of people going into this hall. And I went up to the door, and there's this guy. And the truth is a funny thing, because the truth, the way I remember it, I know can't have happened. But the way I remember it, there's this guy, Larry, really big guy, really friendly guy, standing at the door. I went up to the door, and I said, is this EAA meeting? And the way I remember it is he grabbed my hand and threw me through that door and said, you're in the right place, kid. That's the way I remember it. I know it didn't happen like that, but that's the way I remember it. I only remember two other things from that meeting. The first is I got my 24-hour chip. And like I said, I was a joiner, a chameleon. So I was sitting out with they had round tables in this room. And I was sitting at this table with two other gentlemen. During the break time, they started giving out chips. And girl up front said, 24 hours, knew we were coming back. And they got up. And so I got up and went up to the front, thought it was like communion or something, where everybody went up and got their little white chip every meeting. I had no idea. The other thing I left with was something that I was sorely missing for a long time, and that was hope. Because I heard somebody at the podium, I don't remember, man or woman, basically tell my story, and then they told the rest of it, the rest of it that I'm about to get to, and that is their life got better. And they were able to put down the drink, and they didn't die from this. And I had never seen that happen. I didn't think it was possible. And once I heard that it was possible, I mean, I was already through half step one. I already knew alcohol was killing me. I just didn't know it was possible not to drink. So I heard that at that meeting, that if I didn't want to drink, I didn't have to. Even if I wanted to, I didn't have to. And the basic way it was explained to me was, quit drinking forever. That's this problem up here. Don't drink right now. I can do that. I cannot drink right now. So they told me, break that big problem. I tried to stop drinking a million times. Never worked. Never failed not drinking today so far. So I left that meeting, and I was actually full of hope. I thought, this is it. I might make it. And I told my wife, I think this is it. I might make it. And I'm sure she's heard me say that a million times before, so I don't know if she believed me. But I felt it. I felt different. I felt this time I might actually make it. We had three boys at the time. My youngest boy is 1 month older than I am. My oldest boy, actually his birthday is today, and we're talking about celebrating sobriety. Aaron is 17 years old today, so I'm just going to take a little break. If you all could help me and say happy birthday, Aaron, when I say to three, he'd really appreciate it. One, two, three. Happy birthday, Aaron. I love you, Aaron. Yeah, and Zach and Eli, I love you too. Because I know they don't want to be left out. So I started sobriety, and I was very fortunate in that first group that I joined through no volition of my own. Mostly like my marriage. I'm still married today, mostly due to the efforts of my wife, not myself. But they didn't let me get away with sitting on the edge. They pulled me in. And I remember going to that meeting and everybody saying, hey, Ken, how you doing? Welcome back. And I'm thinking, oh, leave me alone. And then eventually I started saying, I'm doing fine. And through gritted teeth, fine, I'm doing fine. So how you doing? Fine. And then, because I didn't have the alcohol, but I didn't have any coping skills. So I just felt like it was ripped raw. I felt like somebody took sandpaper to my whole body and just tore off all my skin. And every little thing bothered me. And it was worse than when I was drinking as far as my behavior to other people. Because when I was drinking, I was just numb and sitting in the corner. And that every little thing was bothering me. And it took a while before my skin grew back. It took a while before I start to shake other people's hands and start to actually remember names. I couldn't remember anybody's name. The only people's names I remember other than my immediate family were the bartender and waitress. I knew their names. Everybody else, you were just incidental to my life. I don't know who you were. So I started getting active. I started, like, getting out of my own self. Started being in a group of people that were like me. And I can't tell you how much that felt good to just have a group of people that accepted me, because I didn't accept myself at that time. And they gave me a job. My first job in that group was purchasing agent. I had to think about that. Like, am I responsible enough to buy books once a month? I didn't think I was, but they thought I was, and I did that. I know this is AA, but service is part of my story. And about a year and a half into sobriety, I had been active with that group. Around where I got sober, we go on what's called commitments. A bunch of people get in a car and they drive to another group or meeting, and they basically put on a meeting. They all get up at the mic and speak. And where I get sober, when you get 90 days, they thrust you up in front of that microphone. So, you know, I apologize for right now for carrying the mess for a while instead of the message. But it got me over that fear of public speaking. But so I was going around, I was being active, I was seeing other people around where I lived, going to different meetings, and my home group said, "Ken, we need a GSR." And I'm like, "Well, what's a GSR?" And they said, "Well, we don't really know, but you got to go to Leominster once a month and find out when the detox commitments are and find out when the spring dance is, and just do that." I'm like, "Okay, I don't know." So I went home and I thought about it for a week, and I'd be like, "Do I have the capability to have that much responsibility on my shoulders to be able to go to a place once a month and find out when we had detox commitments?" And I did. And I went to that first district meeting, and I saw people in the room that I had been seeing at all these other meetings that were cleaning up the chairs after the meeting and setting up the meetings and being active in the meetings. And I started seeing, like, people outside my own home group, and I started my circle of AA grew a little bit. And then I started getting active in the district, and I started doing things. And then they started talking about these things like sober picnics and spring dances and things like that. Like, I love you people, but I don't want to see you outside of a meeting. And I just, at that time I was like, no, that's good for you. Yeah, you keep doing that. That's great. Until I got suckered into chairing a meeting at the Mass Day Convention. Somebody I knew in service said, "Hey, Ken, I need somebody to chair an As Bill Sees It meeting for me and at this convention thing." I'm like, I don't know if I can do it. And I thought about it, and, okay, maybe I can do it. And I chaired that meeting, and I literally showed up just for the meeting, said hi to a bunch of people, chaired the meeting, and left. And it's an hour drive from my house to where the convention was. I just didn't want to. I loved you, but in small doses. And this is not a small dose. But I started getting out of myself, and I started seeing. And when I was there, one of the things that struck me at the convention was there were a lot of happy, smiling faces on people. So I started getting active in the state conventions. I do other service work after GSR. I ended up being DCM, and then on the area committee and things like that. And that's just taken me some places that I've never even thought to go. But the other thing was I started living outside of AA as well as inside of AA. I started being able to take the lessons I learned in here and apply them to my outside life. I started being able to be involved in my son's family and my son's life and in work. I started being a good coworker and a good worker. And my middle boy joined this Cub Scout pack, and I went to a couple of meetings, and they said, "Hey, we need somebody to be a Cub Master." And by the way, I hated people. And I said, "Well, I can be assistant Cub Master, maybe." And so I raised my hand, and I did that. And then two meetings into my term as assistant Cub Master, the Cub Master didn't show up, so I had to run the thing. So here's a guy that hates people, kids annoy him, and now I'm the cum master with 30 to 40 7 to 10-year-old boys. And I was able to do it. And I found I liked doing that. I found I liked being with people, and I found I liked people. And I found for myself it's because I like myself. The more I found that I've loved myself, the more I'm able to love other people, and the more I think other people are able to like me. And it's all because I started growing. I got a sponsor. I had a sponsor, a name only, for a while. I had a guy's number. I never called him. I was at a district meeting, and there's this a new guy showed up, and he's this loud, boisterous type that I hate. So I made him my sponsor. And he's been wonderful. It's been wonderful to work with him. And he told me not to mention his name if I screwed up. So, but, Mark, I didn't screw up. And he was able to guide me through growth and the steps. And it's just amazing, you know. I found the topic is celebrating sobriety. And my first inclination was just to point to the audience. I mean, anybody here at the meeting last night? And there you go. That's celebrating sobriety. And I guess my time is almost up. She told me she was going to yank me off the stage. But I do want to close with one thing. We're all here celebrating sobriety this weekend, and we're all here together. But I know there's somebody out there in pain, because I've seen it and I've been there myself. If you could please do us a favor, allow us to help you. After this meeting, if you're in pain, turn to the person next to you and say, I'm an alcoholic and I need help. Because two things might happen. One, the person you talk to, they'll get a sense of gratitude and they'll be able to get out of themselves and helping you. And two, you might actually get the help you need. I want to thank you all for helping me stay sober today. My name is Ken. I'm an alcoholic.
Now you've heard from our token man. I am so very glad that he mentioned service work. I always forget to thank people. I want to thank the people who put a dollar or two in the basket when it comes around. Seriously. I want to thank groups who get their meeting schedules listed. I want to thank public information people who get the schedules in the newspaper and now on the internet. I want to thank answering services. I want to thank those people who answer the telephone when they're called, who don't screen their calls, who if they don't recognize a number, they may take it. I got sober because a woman from Knoxville, Tennessee drove 5 hours to take me to my first meeting. I want to thank people in Tennessee for being sober to carry the message to her and for her to be willing to drive to West Virginia and carry the message to me. I mean, for me, it's real fun being up here behind the microphone and, you know, getting to do this. But, you know, our real work is out there. And one of the things I need to remember is that if Bill Wilson had waited for Bob Smith to call him, I don't believe one of us would be in the room tonight. So remember that. Get that newcomer's phone number and you call them. And when it's really inconvenient to take somebody to a meeting, stop and think how much time and work it took to get you here. Please be willing to reach out those hands to the next alcoholic. If I can drive 1,100 miles to talk about myself, I hope I'm willing to drive across town and take somebody to a meeting. Well, we mentioned service work, and I have had the honor and the privilege to serve with Suzette at the General Service Conference because West Virginia will elect anyone delegate. Suzette, however, is a delegate from Arizona, and she's going to be here to bring it on home. Let's welcome Suzette.
Hi, everybody. My name's Suzette, and I'm an alcoholic. Wow. My sobriety date's February 12, 1993, and I'll be grateful forever to Alcoholics Anonymous and a power greater than myself that I found in a very small community called Sholo, Arizona! And that town fits in this room. And if you think I'm kidding, try and find it on the map. You know those little maps we see around town that says market here, you know? It is so small, like the tip of the pin won't even fit in there to find it. Grateful to be here today. Interesting enough, I need to breathe. And I'm grateful to a very loving sponsor who, when I got here and would go into the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, we didn't speak from podiums, but every time I'd walk into the room, she knew I had a fear of microphones, and she would drag this podium that was made by the fellowship there, and she'd drag it, and she'd say, Suzette's here, and I thought, what the heck is she doing? Where am I going to need to use the podium to speak from in Sholo, Arizona? And I'm grateful for those that come before me because they know way better than I do. And I'm grateful to those that come after me because they remind me of where I've been. And I'm certainly grateful to my higher power to allow me to share my experience, strength, and hope with you. My current home group is a Happy Valley group in Happy Valley, Arizona. I'm grateful to find them. It took me a long time to find them. My experience is that I grew up in a normal family like Mary. My mom was a drunk. My father was a drunk. My brothers were exploring girls and alcohol. And my sister was living with her father. And my mom and my dad both had been married 7 different times. So to me, that's the normal family. If you wonder if the disease of alcoholism is a family disease, I'm convinced it is. The way I got here was that my brother was celebrating 1 year of sobriety, and at that time, I had traded in the high-powered career, my 2 daughters at that time, my house and my husband at that time to live on the streets in San Diego to chase alcohol. Now, my experience with Alcoholics Anonymous at that time, actually, let me back up. I was the overachiever while playing with outside issues because I had a resentment with alcohol because, don't you know, I wasn't going to be like my parents. So I sought other mind-altering substances to cure that dis-ease that I had in me. So in high school, I did all those things that normal high school people do. But then I always chased those guys that Mary talked about. But they always had to be 3 years older than me because in high school, when you're 3 years older, you could buy alcohol. And there were 2 requirements. Where you have alcohol by an age and what kind of fast car did you drive? Because the only way that I knew to relate to you guys was to talk about the things that you knew. And I was too afraid to talk about anything else. You know, I'm laughing because these little things are going bobble, bobble, bobble. Anytime somebody would say something to me, I would yes them. You know, yes. If that's what you think, that's what I thought. Yes. And I learned that because I didn't feel like I was anybody when I was growing up. I just thought that I remember having that feeling of just waiting for the best thing to happen, waiting for something different to happen, waiting. And I thought, why am I waiting? You know, I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous that you no longer wait. You know, for me, I had to take action. I had to create my own celebration of sobriety. I started to say the way I got here was I was living on the streets in San Diego. And interesting enough, I was seeking something and had no idea what I was seeking. I was the type of drunk that in the middle of the night I'd get in a fight with the guy that could buy the alcohol or drove the fast car. And I'd just take off and start walking. 2-3 o'clock in the morning. In the streets of El Cajon, that's not too smart of a thing to do for an alcoholic woman. But I would always walk 2 or 3 miles to this church. Now, oddly enough, I never felt good enough because I never made it up the stairs to go into the church. You know, I always felt like I wasn't good enough. So I'm living on the streets, and if you've ever lived on the streets, you have friends that that actually have dwellings, and they let you they allowed me to shower, and I could use their phones. And one day, the phone of my one of my friends rang, and it was my father. Now, I'm so important, I thought my father had a private investigator following me, and that's how he knew where to call, you know. He didn't know that. I had called him from that number, and he had caller ID. Don't call your father when you're drunk, if you don't want to be found. Anyway, he called and said, your brother's celebrating a year of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, what I failed to tell you was I had this resentment against Alcoholics Anonymous because that drunk mother and that drunk father and that brother was chasing alcohol and girls had got sober through the program Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was having a little bit of trouble with alcohol, a little bit of trouble with my mom, and a little trouble with my live-in boyfriend at the age of 15. And my father came and took me from this house, and he claimed that he was sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what he did for me was that he showed me the example, the only example that I knew at that time. He brought me from Phoenix to California against my better judgment and told me he was sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and that he'd been working in steps and that he hadn't had a drink in 2 years. 2 weeks after I got dragged to his house, he started drinking again. So my thought was, if this is what Alcoholics Anonymous has to offer, forget it. I don't want anything to do with it. So when the phone rang and it was my father telling me that my brother was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought, okay, I'll go be the good daughter. So for me, this is where my journey of recovery starts. I had been living on the streets and I had a friend that offered to drive me to the airport. And like any good alcoholic, I procrastinated. The guy showed up. He says, come on, Suzette, we've got to get to the airport. I said, nah, it's okay. I truly wanted to miss the plane. Truly. So about half hour later, we pull up inside the airport. He pulls up to the front of it, and he says, Suzette, get out and go to that booth right there. Okay. So I made the attempt so I could be the good daughter and tell my mother and my father that I did. Don't you know the plane wouldn't wait for me? So I get out and I go to the counter and I say, hi, I'm Suzette. And they said, you're waiting for this plane to Los Angeles, aren't you? I said, yes. They said, hold on. She picked up the phone and she pulled the plane back to the door. Now, the reason that's significant for me is that I haven't found it necessary to have a drink since that day, it was February 9th, 1993. Thank you. I did find it necessary to smoke pot 3 days later. So my sobriety date is February 12th, 1993. That's right. Now what happened for me is that, interesting enough, my brother wasn't sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. He was acting as if. And he got his 1 year chip, but it was instrumental to me because I sat in a hotel room for 5 days and detoxed with my mother, loving me, like the love I find here. I don't know if you guys' cheeks hurt, but my cheeks are dying, and my feet too, because I am smiling so much. I feel like I have come home. And I have to tell you, that's right. And I didn't feel like that on that first day. What happened for me was that I went to this small town. I packed my suitcase. I was going for 5 days. I left 16 years later. I never know what's best for me. I got the opportunity to start growing and start trusting one other woman because I trusted nobody. And I trusted this woman with my life. And somebody said to me, work the steps like you sought your alcohol, you know. Seek God like you sought the men in your life, you know. Turn to something greater than yourself. Trust that. And I had nothing else to turn to. Nothing. So itty-bitty baby steps is what I call it. I use the analogy of my higher power with when we watch our children or our grandchildren grow up or start to learn to walk. I don't know about you, but as a mother, I say, I'd stand on one side just a little bit distance apart, and I'd say, come on, you can make it. Come on, you can make it. And if they fall down, I walk over, and I pick them back up, and I love them, and I give them a little bit more encouragement. And that's my vision of my higher power, because every time I fall down, my higher power is there, picks me back up, and says, come on, Suzette, you can do it. I'll walk with you, and sometimes I'll carry you. And I learned that from other people in Alcoholics Anonymous, not telling me that, but showing me that. Celebrating sobriety. You know, someone said, I said, I'm going to speak on the topic of celebrating sobriety. And someone said, oh, that's going to just be so fun. You can just talk about all the joys. And sobriety is about joy. But I'm here also to tell you that sobriety for me is about walking through the things that are difficult for me and that I want to run from, that I want to say, I don't want to do this, that I want to drink over. And for you guys to give me those tools and say that I can get to the other end and that everything's going to be okay. I learned that here in Alcoholics Anonymous, to trust one other person to say, you know, like Ken said, if you're hurting, tell somebody because you're going to feel better. And that wasn't my experience in the past. My experience was to hold it in. And today I've learned that with that tool bag you guys gave me, I don't have to do that today. And what a relief. And to find that higher power that I found in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and to know, to absolutely know that no matter what I'm going through, there's something there that cares about me. And I never felt like that. I never felt that anybody cared about me. And I never felt that I could walk through a crowd of 60,000 people and say, hi, I love you, how are you? And to truly mean that. You know, that's celebrating the sobriety of alcohol, of recovery. And then sitting one-on-one with a woman. That's how I've been taught, woman to woman. I'm sitting one-on-one with a woman and sharing my deepest, darkest secrets so that person knows that, you know, she's not alone. You know, those are the things that I celebrate today. And then lastly, to have a loving family in my life, to have a mother here that's with me. She's 28 years sober sitting here. To have a... to have a relationship with a husband that he never bought me alcohol, and he's not 3 years older than me. You know, that's a miracle. And to learn to take the opportunity to listen to what others have to say, to be open-minded, to be willing, and then most of all, to be honest with myself about what's going on with me. Those are things that I celebrate here. And those are the things that you guys taught me. And to celebrate having grandchildren. People look at me and go, you have grandchildren? I do. And to look at them, it was interesting, Mary's talking about, my husband and I started getting this resentment because we don't get to see our grandsons enough, you know. And I talked about taking action. And for a couple of days, I was angry about it. You know, my old character defect, I get angry. And because, don't you know, they're not doing it how I want them to do it. And then finally, thank goodness for daily reflections. Because I was taught to read that every morning, and I still do today. And what it said to me, take action. So I thought, okay, what can I do differently? You know, so every Tuesday night we go and pick up our grandson and we take the opportunity to have a relationship with him. And I'm not waiting for something to happen. I'm taking action. So I'm grateful for that. You guys had a great time this weekend. Celebrate your sobriety. Know that it's not all about happiness. That's my experience. And know that as we trudge or walk with purpose, that we're doing that together. Thank you.
Well, y'all know I like audience participation, so we have one more thing to do. We're going to sing a little song. Most of y'all know the tune. It's to the tune of Happy Birthday. And it's going to be Happy Birthday, AA. Happy Birthday, AA. 75 years of recovery. Happy Birthday, AA. Are we ready? Happy Birthday, AA. Happy Birthday, AA. 75 years of recovery.